WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nick Hornby is great at writing about pop culture obsessives. His novel High Fidelity was about a guy in his 30s who runs a used record store and judges everyone according to their taste in music. His new novel, About a Boy, is about a 36-year-old guy who spends his days and nights immersed in his record collection or watching television. He can afford to do that. He lives off the royalties of his late father's novelty Christmas hit. But it's hard for him to have relationships with women until he figures out that a lot of men don't like dating single mothers, so he'd have less competition and more appreciation in that field. This seems like such a good strategy, he eventually invents an imaginary child so he can pose as a sympathetic single father, even though he doesn't much like children. Through this little scam, he ends up meeting a 12-year-old named Marcus, who becomes quite attached to him. Here's a reading. Will, the main character, has just figured out that he stands a better chance of scoring if he focuses on single mothers. His current girlfriend, Angie, has two kids.
They went to McDonald's. They went to the Science Museum and the Natural History Museum. They went on a boat down the river. On the very few occasions when he had thought about the possibility of children, always when he was drunk, always in the first throes of a new relationship, he had convinced himself that fatherhood would be a sort of sentimental photo opportunity. And fatherhood Angie style was exactly like that. He could walk hand in hand with a beautiful woman, children gambling happily in front of him, and everyone could see him doing it, and when he'd done it for an afternoon, he could go home again if he wanted to. And then there was the sex. Sex with a single mother, Will decided after his first night with Angie, beat the sort of sex he was used to, hands down. If you pick the right woman, someone who'd been messed around and eventually abandoned by the father of her children, and who hadn't met anyone since, because the kids stopped you going out, and anyway, a lot of men didn't like kids that didn't belong to them, and they didn't like the kind of mess that frequently coiled around these kids like a whirlwind. If you picked one of these, then she loved you for it. All of a sudden, you became better looking, a better lover, a better person. As far as he could see, it was an entirely happy arrangement. All those so-so couplings going on out in the world of the childless singles, to whom a night in a foreign bed was just sex. They didn't know what they were missing. Sure, there were right-on people, men and women, who would be repelled and appalled by his logic, but that was fine by him. It reduced the competition.
That's Nick Hornby reading from his new novel, About a Boy. The other advantage your main character finds in dating single mothers is that the single mothers are often not yet ready to be in a long-term relationship, so they break up apologetically with him, which means he gets to have great sex without commitment, and that's delightful for him.
That's his logic, yeah.
I think a lot of single mothers assume that men find them difficult because of the child. How did you come to see the other side of that?
I know a fair few people who had gone out with almost a string of single mothers, and I think that for some of them it was kind of a rehearsal for what they wanted to do later on, but not something they were ready to do properly yet. And so these people kind of met their needs. I mean, that sounds cynical, but I don't think they were intending it to be cynical at the time. But I think it does have an appeal for men.
Your main character, Will, is actually very afraid of the idea of being a real father. He thinks that children really mess up people's lives and mess up people's marriages, and they're sloppy and messy and time-consuming. Did you go through a period of that yourself, watching your friends who were married and who were having children and who had less time for movies and books and soccer matches, the things that you're really obsessed with?
Well, I think that everyone who knows anyone with a child or has children themselves goes through this.
Did it make you think, well, I'm not going to fall into that trap and have children myself?
No. I mean, I have a child, so and it was a conscious decision to have a child, so clearly it didn't affect me all the way. But I think if you ask any parent, they have a fantasy that they want time and space, and of course they wouldn't be without their children, but time and space is a really big deal.
The main character in your book ends up meeting a 12-year-old who's the son of the friend of the woman he's dating. And a lot of the book is about their relationship. And, you know, his mother, the teenager's mother is a vegetarian who won't let him eat at McDonald's or wear Adidas sneakers or listen to the current rock hits. She likes to sing old Joni Mitchell songs. And that's where your main character comes in. He's a pop culture maven, and he can tell the kid about Kurt Cobain and buy him stylish sneakers. Do you think that parents often make a mistake when they try to regulate their kids' pop culture diets?
Yeah, I think this is a very difficult line to draw. When I was growing up as a kid in England, I was voracious in my consumption of pop culture. But that still actually left me quite a lot of free time because TV, we had some Saturday morning TV when I was kind of older, and there was an hour of children's television between 5 and 6 every evening. But that was it. There was no daytime stuff. We had one pop channel on the radio, so I could consume all I like, and it didn't, you know, as I say, it didn't take up too much of my time. But I think now parents are faced with a different set of problems.
The main character in your book is wants to be basically a pop culture mentor to the 12-year-old who enters his life. And I think that that's the fantasy that a lot of adults have, a lot of adults who are really deep into music and movies and television, that, well, maybe it's hard for them to relate to teenagers, but they can relate to teenagers on the basis of, you know, movies and books and television shows and all of that. Was that a fantasy of yours, that, you know, you would have this kind of natural connection to teenagers, no matter how alienated the teenagers were?
I taught for a while, and part of the reason that I wanted to teach was because I thought, you know, I could connect with kids because I knew who the Sex Pistols were and who played for Manchester United. But you kind of get disabused of that very quickly, I think, because any cool kid really doesn't want to know what an old guy, especially an old guy who's a teacher, has to say about anything at all. Marcus, in the book, he knows nothing, and because he knows nothing, he's struggling at school. So Will can fulfill a need in him.
But you found it hard to fulfill that need as a teacher. Well, the kids didn't have that need, I guess. I mean,
yeah, exactly. I mean,
they already knew stuff.
Yeah, when one has the fantasy that you're talking about, I think it's quite right. Adults do have that fantasy, and you have the fantasy that you're going to be sitting down with the coolest kid in the class and talking about, you know, REM or Nirvana. And they really don't want to hear from you, those kids.
I'll tell you what I think the fantasy really is, too, that a lot of people in their 30s, 40s, and maybe early 50s have. I think it's this, that when they were teenagers, they were much hipper than their parents were. But now that they're adults, they're a lot hipper than their kids are. don't you think?
I think that's absolutely right, yes.
How old were your students when you taught?
I taught 11 to 16-year-olds.
And you were teaching them English?
Yeah.
And what did you feel you could best relate to them about?
Actually, soccer was okay, because there isn't a kind of hip thing or an unhip thing. There's just kind of knowledge, really. And you can just talk to kids about sport as equals, whereas I think with pop music, there's always a lot of jousting going on. And if you're older than, you know, well, obviously a teacher, you're older than your kids, and I think you always want to say to them, yeah, well, they're good, but, you know, have you listened to the Velvet Underground? Because that's where they're getting this stuff from, and that's where the kids start to, you know, they start to roll their eyeballs and walk away from you.
Well, how would you feel when that happened?
What, with kids walking away from you?
Yeah, after you suggested a band as worthy as the Velvet Underground, to have a kid, like, roll his eyes and walk away and see you as the tedious adult.
Well, it's actually what happens with all culture, isn't it, in schools, that you see a kid reading a book that's one-tenth as good as The Catcher in the Rye but tries to aim for the same kind of thing, and you try and suggest The Catcher in the Rye, the kid's going to walk away as well. And it's really a way of turning pop culture into high culture, where some things are better than other things and some things are worthier than other things, and kids really don't want to know about that. They want to know about who's hip and who's not hip and who means something to them now at this moment. and not who's going to last and who's not going to last.
One of the things I found very amusing in your novel is when the adult character will decides, you know, he'll spend a day with the 12-year-old and try to keep him entertained, but he can't think of, well, what should I do with him? What's going to keep him amused? The kid wants to go to Planet Hollywood, which is about right. about the last place that Will, the main character, wants to go to. And that really made me think about how difficult it is, I think, when there are children in your life who want to go to all these kind of big pop culture extravaganza type things that you might really hate, that you might think are just like the tackiest, most kind of false and corporate things out there. But what can you do? I mean, the kid wants to go. What are you going to do?
I mean, a lot of that is about belonging to mainstream, and Marcus is desperate to belong to the mainstream. You know, he's desperate to be able to go to school and say that he went to Planet Hollywood, because he doesn't have very many ways in which he can relate to his classmates. And I think, again, when you're hip, as Will thinks he is, the last thing you want to do is belong to the mainstream. You want to take people away from the mainstream, tell them a place that maybe they don't know about. And, of course, that's precisely not the point for Marcus. He has to go somewhere where he does know about.
Nick Hornby is my guest, and we're talking about his new novel, which is called About a Boy. He's also the author of the novel High Fidelity. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nick Hornby. His new novel is called About a Boy. There's a lot of depression in your new book. The mother of the teenage boy is a suicidal depressive. Kurt Cobain kills himself during the course of the book. There's a teenager who's, a depressive. Were you thinking about how frightening it must be for young people when there are people who are chronically depressed in their life, and how difficult it must be to understand and to cope with?
Yeah, I'd had bouts of depression myself in my late 20s. And it is something that interests me, I think, depression. I think probably all three of my books have dealt with depression in some way or another. I think Rob in High Fidelity is kind of gloomy, if not depressed, and I wanted to take that a step further. But one of the things that I do in spare time, as I'm a patron of a children's charity called Young Minds, which is actually supposed to deal with kids who have mental health problems. I mean, not handicaps, but mental health problems. There's no other charity like it in the UK, and that is something that I think is incredibly important, that we tend to underestimate kids' depression.
Do you think you had depression as a kid?
Yeah, I think probably I did, actually, for a couple of years in my early teens. I mean, maybe I was just having teenage blues, but I think for all of us it's very hard to separate one from the other.
How did it manifest itself?
gloominess, really. Great desire to be on my own for chunks of the day and read and listen to music with headphones on. I mean, you know, anyone who's got a teenage kid, I think, recognises these symptoms. Whether one would classify it as depression or not, I'm not sure. It felt like it at the time.
Do you think that depression kind of helps feed your recorded movie and television and book habits, you know, your obsessions with immersing yourself in that part of life?
I think that's right. I think that, I've always had a theory that obsessives do have some sense of depression, and that obsession is a form of oblivion in a way. That, you know, if you can train yourself to spend 3 or 4 hours in a second-hand record shop flicking through album sleeves, that you don't have to think about anything else. So I think that there's got to be something of that in there. But I think that depression's definitely fueled my writing, and I think that one of the things that strikes a chord with people is that a lot of them are gloomy.
A lot of the characters are gloomy?
No, a lot of the readers are gloomy, and they kind of recognise that. I mean, it's a lot of it is a comedy born of glumness.
Nick Hornby is my guest, and his new novel, which we're talking about, is called About a Boy. I read in a review of one of your books that your son is autistic. And I was thinking, you know, after reading this book about an adult who first relates to a teenager, you know, who first has a teenager come into your life, how totally unprepared you must have been to have a child who is autistic and who is going to be, you know, very different from whatever expectations you had when you decided you were going to become a father.
Yeah, I think, especially if you make your living out of words, the kind of basic expectation you have as a parent is that whatever else you're going to be able to talk to your kid. My kid doesn't talk, so that was a huge readjustment to have to learn about.
You probably also had all these fantasies about being this kind of pop culture mentor to your child. You're teaching them about your favorite books and records and movies, etc.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of do that. And my son really likes music, and he watches a lot of videos, although he watches the same sort of four videos over and over again. But that's not such a big deal, really. I'm sure that he will respond to music in some form or another. I think that you just have to be inventive in the ways that you relate.
How much time... I know you're also separated. How much time can you spend with your son now?
Well, I see him every day. I live and work around the corner, so I give him his bath every day, and I give him lunch a couple of times a week when he's not at school. So, and I spend weekends with him. So it's really not very much less than it ever was.
I'm wondering how... it's hard to answer questions like this without, you know, being false, I think. But how do you think you've been changed by having a son who is autistic and being exposed to a completely different way of relating to the world?
That is a very hard question to answer. I think that it's made me tougher in some ways. That I think when I first started writing, and the writing really took off quite quickly in England with my first book, and I think it's quite easy to get overwhelmed in those circumstances, that you end up doing what people want you to do, and it's hard to say no to things. But the moment that Danny was diagnosed, it became much easier in a way to keep time for yourself and to almost hide behind him to a certain extent. You can afford to be much tougher with people as a result of something like that.
What do you mean to be tougher with people?
It's very easy for me now to tell people to shove off if they're kind of getting in my face or wanting to take up time, because the time is for Danny. Also, money is for Danny as well. So it kind of makes you feel better about earning. And, you know, I've earned quite well over the last few years. And that makes you feel kind of weird, I think, at first, because you think, what's all this for? But now I know what it's all for.
Right. My guest is Nick Hornby, and he's the author of the new novel About a Boy. Your current novel About a Boy is going to be adapted into a movie, I think, by Robert De Niro's production company. And your previous novel, High Fidelity, is being made into a movie. And I think your first book, Fever Pitch, about soccer, was already made into a movie that didn't make it into the States. Have you had any input into the screenplays for any of those films?
I wrote the screenplay for Fever Pitch. So that I had sort of very close involvement with. And I was really working with friends on the project. And That was a great experience, but the other two I just sold on, and I haven't had any involvement in them so far. I'm actually going to meet the guy who's adapting About a Boy tomorrow, so you know, I'll be talking to him about it then. But it's his business now.
How do you feel about that? About handing over control of your characters to someone else?
I feel absolutely fine about it. It was. But High Fidelity and About a Boy were conceived as books, and I'm happy with the books, and that was kind of the end of the process for me. And if people want to take it on and try and do something else with it, I think that they're perfectly at liberty to do so. I think, you know, it's a straightforward transaction with writing, that if you want to sell your film rights, then do so, but don't whine about what happens afterwards.
The title of your new book, About a Boy, is named after a record. Do you want to talk a little bit about the record you named it after and why?
Well, Yeah, it's quite complicated, isn't it? It turns out it's named after several records. I thought of the title after the Nirvana song about a girl. The book is set in at the end of 93, beginning of 94, and Kurt Cobain's death does feature in it, so it seemed entirely appropriate. And the boy, as in about a boy, I think it could refer to either Marcus or Will. But then I remembered, actually, I had completely forgotten that Patti Smith wrote a song called About a Boy, about Kurt Cobain, so I guess I must have pinched her title rather than the Nirvana title.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Nick Hornby's new novel is called About a Boy. Here's Nirvana's recording, About a Girl. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.